Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Butchery.
This evening, I'm flying solo, but talking about one of my favorite subjects, storytelling. We've also got a great interview with conjure man and priest in the Lukumi and Pelo traditions, Dr. E. We'll finish up with a bit of listener feedback. Hello, and thanks for joining me this evening. As I said in the intro, it's just me tonight. Lane has been swamped lately, and with a baby on the way and a series of other setbacks on my end, we just haven't been able to get together to record. But I wanted to get at least one more episode out before the baby arrives, after which there will probably be a small break before we will come back in full force. Lane will be back for those episodes, so you only have to put up with me for this one. And you don't even have to listen to me drone on by my lonesome the entire time, as we've got a great interview with Dr. E., a West Coast conjurer and initiate of the African traditional religions of Lukumi, often called Santeria, and Pelo. Before we get to that, however, let's talk a little bit about storytelling. I've mentioned many times before how important I think storytelling is to those interested in magical traditions. Often, stories are one of the few things that preserve magical lore more or less intact over long periods of time. The information is frequently encoded in tales that seem at first glance to be straightforward entertainments. Most people listening to this probably know about the Jungian idea of archetypes and the theory that all stories share certain commonalities and links that prove universal, quote-unquote, to humanity. Tales about unrequited love, overcoming impossible odds, and the fundamental nature of human beings all show up across myriad cultures and time periods, for example. Why do fairy and folk tales, though, offer such a safe haven for magical lore? I've seen a number of theories on this. Fairy and folk tales were traditionally the province of women and therefore not taken seriously by domineering men who attempted to purge quote-unquote respectable society of anything that smacked of magic or the other world. These tales are diminished mythology, which was intentionally watered down and suppressed by medieval monks trying to further a Christian agenda. Or conversely, that monks preserved these sorts of stories precisely because they knew that the church, as a body, would be trying to stamp out non-Christian stories, and they couldn't bear to lose their local traditions, customs, and history in that process. Any of these theories may hold some water depending on the time and place one is examining, but my personal take is that people simply love a good witch in a story, and likewise they love their familiar demons, monsters, angels, and saints. No oligarchy is going to be able to quash every last weed of folk belief, and at a certain point it becomes more troublesome to try and prove that a fairy tale about a witch actually contains elements of witchcraft than it is to simply say, that's kids' stuff, or that's women's stuff in many cases. For whatever the reason, the oral tradition of tale-telling has been with us since ancient days and continues going strong today. There are excellent tellers such as Sarah of Forest Grove and Hedge Folk Tales podcast, who intentionally mine old stories to bring up relevant magical and ritual lore. There are storytellers who tell for the love of telling, and in conveying their stories, they preserve that information for others to plumb. There are even modern troubadours like Bob Dylan and Muddy Waters who sing songs about men dressed in black at crossroads and roots bundled up and left at someone's doorstep who preserve this sort of folklore in popular song. As a practicing folk magician, I know that my whole reference library, with all its tomes on herbal correspondences and moon phases, is worth almost nothing compared to the volumes of regional folklore that I've collected. I turn to Vance Randolph, Richard Dorson, Hubert Davies, and Zora Neale Hurston, all famous folklorists and ethnographers who've recorded tales deeply seeded with magic, more than I do to my Catherine Ironwood herbal or Judica Elish spellbook, though I do love those too. Storytelling is vital to some traditions. Lukumi, which Dr. E. will mention tonight, requires a familiarity with the Apatakis, or Patakis, tales of spirits and orishas which guide an initiate on his or her path. Even in those traditions which do not have heavily embedded oral folklore magical histories, stories still crop up and frame a number of the ritual aspects of religion. What would Pesach be without the story of Moses and the plagues, for instance? Or Christmas without the nativity story, or even the movie A Christmas Story. To that end, tonight I'm going to share a trio of stories with you, which come from African roots. First, I'll be telling you the Ashanti tale of Anansi and Anene going fishing. Then I'll have a Bahamian tale about the devil and a fisherman. Finally, we'll have the tale of Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Fox at the well. I think you'll see lots of connections between the three stories, and I'd love to hear what your take is on these tales, magically speaking. So without further ado, let's get to that first story. Anansi and Anene go fishing. An Ashanti tale about Anansi the spider and Anene the crow. One day, Anansi asked Anene if he would help Anansi set out some fish traps. Anene, having nothing better to do and thinking how good a fish might taste, agreed. When they arrived near the shores of the lake, however, Anansi informed Anene that they had forgotten to bring traps, and they would have to make some out of the bushes growing on the shore.
"Give me the knife," said Anansi. "I will cut the branches and thatch the traps together. You must do the labor of sitting under the shade of the palm trees and getting tired for me. That will be your task."
Anene did not like the sound of this and said,
"I do not want to get tired. No, I shall do all the cutting and thatching, and you shall sit under the shade and get tired instead."
Anansi shrugged his shoulders and went over to doze in the shade. Anene, meanwhile, toiled in the hot sun and grew quite weary, but contented himself that he was not so weary as Anansi, who was clearly so tired he'd fallen asleep. When the traps were ready, Anene roused Anansi and they went to the water's edge.
"Now," said Anansi, "I will carry these traps out into the water and set them. You must follow behind me and take up my share of the weariness for me."
"No," cried Anene. "I do not want to be weary. I shall set the traps, and you shall stay behind and grow weary."
Again, Anansi shrugged his shoulders, and Anene did the labor of setting the traps. The next day, they returned to check the traps, and Anansi said,
"I shall wade out and check the traps. You should stay behind, for if I am bitten by a great fish or water snake, you must do the job of dying in my place."
Anene again balked at Anansi, and insisted on checking the traps himself, to which Anansi shrugged his shoulders and sat down on the shore, humming a quiet tune. When Anene brought the traps back, they took out the fish, and Anansi said,
"Oh my, these fish are all so small. You take them, Anene, and I shall wait until tomorrow, when we shall surely catch bigger fish."
"No," said Anene, "you shall take these, and I shall take the bigger fish tomorrow."
Anansi shrugged his shoulders and took the fish home to eat. Anene went hungry. The next day, the same thing happened, with Anene insisting on checking the traps and bringing them ashore. The fish were bigger this time, but there were few of them.
"Well, well, well, a good decision you've made, Anene," said Anansi. "These are big fish, and you shall take them. I shall wait until tomorrow, when there will surely be more of these big fish, now that our traps are working so well."
Anene again balked, and insisted that Anansi take the big fish so that Anene could have the larger load of bigger fish the next day. So it went on for a long time this way, with Anansi always tricking Anene out of his share of the fish and always convincing Anene to do all the work. When the traps finally wore out, Anansi said he would take them to town and sell them and bring back the money so that Anene could buy some fish finally. When he got to town, he began announcing that he had rotten fish traps for sale, and all the people began to laugh at him. Then the chief of the village said that Anansi must think them all fools to buy rotten fish traps, and so they all drove Anansi away, where he hid in dark corners for shame over not selling his fish traps. And there he sits to this day, hiding in places where others will not go. Sunday Fishing, a folktale from the Bahamas. There was once a man, a good man in many ways, but who loved to fish so much that he would often go fishing on Sundays. One Sunday, as he sat out in his boat with his line in the water, the devil appeared in the boat with him and said, "Let us fish together so that we may catch bigger, better fish." The man was very afraid, but thought that the devil might drown him if he didn't agree, and so they both cast their lines into the water. Before long, they hauled up a huge fish, and the man was very, very happy. He got out his knife to cut the fish into two portions, one for himself and one for the devil. But just as he was about to cut the fish, the devil said,
Now you don't cut this fish. You don't split this fish. But you better share this fish.
The man was puzzled, and didn't know how to share the fish without cutting or splitting it. He rowed back to the shore pondering this, and as soon as he got to the land, he ran off towards his house. The devil cast his line out after the man, hooking him by his hair and dragging him back to the boat.
Now you don't cut this fish, and you don't split this fish, but you better share this fish, the devil said again.
The man was terrified and pulled out his knife again, trying every way he knew how to make the fish two parts without cutting or splitting it. Finally, he gave up and said to the devil,
I can't share this fish without cutting or splitting it.
The devil grinned and said,
Oh, well then, you can keep the fish, and I'll keep you.
And with that, the devil swallowed the man up whole. Ebo Ben, my story ends.
Brer Rabbit and Brer Fox at the Well, a story of the South adapted from the Uncle Remus Tales by Joel Chandler Harris. Brer Rabbit and Brer Fox were friends, but they were the kind of friends who always liked to play jokes on one another. Brer Rabbit was awful clever, though, so more often than not, Brer Fox was the one who got the short end of the stick when these jokes were played. One day, Brer's Rabbit, Fox, Coon, and Bar were cleaning away some new ground, and the sun was getting mighty hot. Brer Rabbit looked for an opportunity to sneak away and find some shade and refreshment. And so when he was carrying a load of briars, he made a great yelp and called out that he'd gotten a thorn stuck in his hand. The other animals all excused him as he went off to find something to fix up his hand. And before long, Brer Rabbit had found a well that had a rope with a bucket at either end hanging in it. The dark of the well and the sound of the water rushing below tempted Brer Rabbit, and so he jumped in the bucket and plunged down, down, down into the dark well, stopping only inches from the rushing underground stream. Brer Rabbit was mighty scared, not knowing how to get out and afraid the bucket would spill any second and he'd be swept away by that stream. Back above ground, though, Brer Fox had been following Brer Rabbit to see what he was up to, and he saw him jump into the bucket and down into the well. At first, this puzzled Brer Fox, but then he got to thinking, Well, I bet that Brer Rabbit keeps all his money down that hole, and he's just going to put some more down there. Or maybe he got himself a gold claim under that well. Whatever he's got, it's got to be good, and I'm going to find out what it is. With that, he went up to the mouth of the well and called down after Brer Rabbit.
Hey-o, Brer Rabbit! Who you visiting down there? He cried.
Brer Rabbit thought quick as lightning and said,
Oh, me? I'm just fishing, Brer Fox. Lots of them down here just waiting to be caught. I'm fishing for suckers myself.
I want some of those fish, cried Brer Fox. How do I get down there?
Brer Rabbit laughed to himself and said,
Well, you gotta jump in that other bucket up there and get down here.
Well, Brer Fox wasted no time, but as soon as he was in that bucket, it started going down, down, down into the well. At the same time, Brer Rabbit's bucket went up, 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 and as the two buckets passed, he called out,
Goodbye, Brer Fox! Take care of you close! Well, this is the way the world goes. Sometimes goes up and sometimes goes down. You'll get to the bottom all safe and sound.
When the bucket reached the top, Brer Rabbit hopped out and ran off back to the others.
He told them about poor Fox's predicament, and they all went back to go rescue him before the men with their big guns came along and found him. Soon they were all back working the new ground, with Brer Rabbit busting out in the laugh ever so often, and Brer Fox giving him a case of the dry grins.
Do you dream of living a simpler life out in the country with the classic red barn and prerequisite chickens and a garden? Do you long to have fresh food that was grown organically and didn't have to travel 1,500 miles to reach your plate? Well, if you're a city slicker with big country dreams, head on over to the Pagan Homesteader, where we will look at homesteading from a pagan perspective. Here we will talk about various farm animals, organic gardening, permaculture, rainwater catchment, downsizing, and everything it takes to create our simpler life. Okay, so maybe it's not always that simple. Anyway, pull up a chair as we learn about all things homesteading, and I share ideas on how you can create your own urban homestead. Happy homesteading, everyone!
Hi, this is Velma Nightshade from Witches Brew Haha, inviting you to join me each week as I discuss all things witchy. Witches Brew Haha reaches from the controversial topics to the ridiculous reality that being a modern witch entails. From book reviews to hot-button pagan news, from stone and herb studies to practical magic tips and advice, Witches Brew Haha is a bewitching blend of the best a magical life has to offer. Find it on iTunes or at witchesbrewhaha.com. And remember, never be afraid to think outside the cauldron. Blessed be.
Tonight we have with us Dr. E. Dr. E is a traditional hoodoo root worker offering his services and conjure to those in need. He has an extensive background as a spiritual medium, tarot reader, energy worker, herbalist, and magician. You can read his blog on hoodoo, conjure, and Afro-Caribbean magical traditions at conjuredoctor.blogspot.com. His online shop, where you can purchase products ranging from holy oil to sugar daddy oil to GTFO oil, is at www.conjuredoctor.com. He can be found on Facebook and Twitter as well. Dr. E, welcome to New World Witchery.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being on the show. We're really glad to get to talk to you. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. You have a great site.
Well, thank you. Likewise, and I'm a big fan of your podcast.
Thank you very much. So the first question I have to ask is, what does that E stand for?
Well, it's funny, you know, when you first start putting yourself out there in the public realm as a professional root worker, you kind of come to a crossroad where you can decide, you know, am I going to use my conventional, you know, street name, or am I going to give myself a bit of a title, something with a little more gravitas to it? So the E stands for Edward, which is actually my first name.
Okay.
So that's what I did. I decided to make it something simple, Dr. E, and it just kind of stuck. You know, my first few clients, I think I actually had a client early on that started calling me Dr. Ed, and then, Dr. Ed became just Dr. E, and then sometimes he'd just call me E. And so I was like, all right, this, I kind of like that. I'm going to go with that.
Excellent. I wasn't sure, you know, you have all the, you know, the Dr. Snake and the Doc Buzzard and all that. So I just wasn't sure if it was, you know, Dr. Eagle and had gotten shortened or something.
Got it. Yeah. The doctor is actually a reference to a doctor in divinity that I have through some of my comparative religion studies that I've done over the years.
Wow. Wow. Well,
yeah.
I'll be a fish out of water in this conversation then, but excellent. Can you tell us a little bit about the different types of root work you do?
Well, gosh, where do I start? I mean, there's what I do, and then there's what people really call upon me to do. Mm-hmm. The areas of expertise that I have sort of discovered over time, because you know how root work is, you find that you have kind of an inborn talent for certain types of workings. I originally went into root work mainly aimed around doing love and protective work, which I'd always been very talented at. And over the years, I discovered that I have a natural skill for and a penchant for curse work, as well as reconciliation work. And I know there's a joke in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Is it not the same thing in some cases?
Sometimes it feels like it. Reconciliation work, uncrossing work is something that I'm exceptionally good at. And someone once told me that, and I was just kind of stored that in the back of my mind until I really started putting it into action. I was told by a spiritual reader that one of the reasons I'd be really good at breaking curses off people was because I was cursed in the womb. And I almost died actually in childbirth. I was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck, and every time my mom pushed, I would get strangled, and my heart rate would dip, and eventually they had to do a cesarean section to get me out. And they saved me. But because I survived that curse, I'm sort of innately able to take curses off of other people and cleanse them of them really well. And then the counterpart of that is I'm able to fling curses really effectively if need be. And, that was a whole you know, rite of passage was finally getting to that place where I felt comfortable doing more of that aggressive attack magic when it's appropriate, when it's justified. But I mainly do a lot of reconciliation work, uncrossing work, and job spells. I'm really good at getting people job spells and bringing some money their way.
I bet that's really popular right now.
You know what's funny? That's what you'd think with the economy where it's at. But 75% of my clients are reconciliation clients. It's like they'd rather be miserable but in the company of somebody that is also miserable than have money to get them out of their misery. So it's kind of ironic. But at the same time, you know, I guess people ultimately really just want to feel understood and feel like they've got somebody by their side in life more so than money. You know, it's wealth of the heart is more important to people, I think, in this time and age. So,
yeah, love sort of trumps money in that situation.
Right.
That's fascinating about the umbilical cord as well. I mean, I know in a lot of shamanic cultures, they talk about the birth wound.
Yes.
So that just reminds me a lot of that sort of being marked from birth for that path.
Yeah. And the other thing that's kind of interesting as well is that, you know, I am an initiated priest in La Regla Lucumi, which is derogatorily known as Santeria.
Mm-hmm.
And in the original Yoruban African traditional religion, that was sort of the trunk from which Santeria branched off of. If a child is born with its umbilical cord around its neck, it is automatically called Aina, which is the spirit of fire that taught Shango how to fire. Some people say it's Shango's sister. And those people are automatically initiated as priests of Shango. And it just so happens that I am a priest of Shango, and I was initiated to Shango. So it's kind of another interesting coincidence in how fate sort of lines up the way it does.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, then what brought you to root work in the first place? Did you come through Regla Lucumia? I'm terrible with pronunciations.
That's pretty good, actually. it's kind of interesting. I had a very, you know, circuitous path that found me there. I originally started out, I was raised Catholic. You know, I'm actually a first generation American. My family is Cuban. Hmm. And so, you know, I always was familiar with the Lucumi religion, because it's in the music, it's in the sayings, it's just kind of marinated throughout the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even though my family didn't do any of that, you know, and so I was always interested in it. And, you know, in my various occult studies and learning about, you know, the Wicca and traditional craft and shamanism and all these other things, there was always this call to learn about Lucumi. So I decided one day to go for it, and I was introduced to Lucumi through the most unlikely of characters, actually. My first godfather was a Caucasian man with blonde hair and blue eyes that barely spoke any Spanish, you know. Uh-huh. And it was kind of funny that he would be my entree into that religion. And he trained me. He wasn't my initiator, but he did train me. Eventually, I was initiated in New York, in the Bronx, in November of 2001. But prior to my initiation in Lucumi, I was initiated in the Afro-Caribbean religion of Palo mm-hmm. Quimbisa specifically. And Palo is not related to Lucumi at all. People oftentimes make the mistake of associating those two things, but they're not related. Palo is actually the magical religious system of the Congo people, which is further down the African coast than mm-hmm. the Yoruba people. And the Congos were the first slaves that were brought over to the New World.
Mm-hmm.
And many Afro-Caribbean religions branch off of Palo. There are elements of Palo in Haitian voodoo. There are elements of Palo in Obeya. There mm-hmm. are elements of Palo, of the traditional Congo religion in Palo. And there are elements of the traditional Congo religion in the magical practices of hoodoo.
Mm-hmm.
They just stripped the religion out and kept the magical technology, if you will. And so I was always interested in learning how to cast a better spell. You know what I mean? And my godfather, unfortunately, ended up being a very unethical person. Mm-hmm. And I quickly parted ways with him. And so I never got I got the religious training, but I didn't get the real magical training. I'm like, you know, if I need to, you know, bring someone's lover back, how do I do that? What's the magical spell to do that? And when I found out about root work and its shared magical technological, you know, technique with Palo, I said, you know what? I want to learn this as a way for me to expand this religious knowledge that I already have in Palo.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started investigating it for quite some time. And then I learned about the Lucky Mojo correspondence course. And I decided, you know, let me just take this and let me see. It's an excellent course. It's very thorough. And Kat has done a tremendous job preserving a lot of that that culture and tradition and practices in her writings. And many of which are free for people, you know, just online.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the course and I finished it out. And when I was done and I looked back on everything that I had done, I was like, I kind of already knew how to do all this. You know, I'm absolutely sure that I've been doing it right all along, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started weaving some of that into my Palo practice, and my current incarnation of root work that I do. There are sometimes moments where I will use more of a Palo bent on things because I need a more aggressive, spirit of the dead, ancestral type magical working to address the situation. But, you know, for the most part, most of my work is old traditional pray the psalms, you know, light your candles and, you know, take your magical baths kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And just every once in a while, I need to pull out the big Palo stick and beat people with it, you know. So yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Mm, it definitely does. So you mentioned the training. What kind of training did you undergo?
In which of these various things?
in any of them, really. The Cat's Rootwork course you mentioned, I should say yeah. that you're a member of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers as well, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, the great thing about being a part of that is we all agree to a set of ethics. So, you know, if you get a rootworker from AIR, you're going to get somebody that has said, hey, I'm going to follow these ethical rules. And then, you know, clients can go and, you know, if they ever have a problem, there's an ombudsman for mediation. So there's lots of benefits to doing that. I mainly did it so that I could get my name out there, you know, mm-hmm. and of course that's a benefit in a practical sense. But in terms of training, I mean, when you learn in the African traditional religions, you're learning in a very apprenticeship type of educational system. It's not like sit down, we're going to have formal classes. It's stand by my side while we work this ritual. Stand by my side while we do this ceremony. Go get me that over there. Grab the gunpowder. Grab this. Grab that candle. Go do this. Hand me the machete. You know, whatever. It's that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And you do it, and then later you can go back to your godparent or, you know, and say, okay, why did we do this? Why was this particular symbol used? Why did we use this substance? Okay, if I wanted to do a variation of that, how would I do it? And so it's literally old school apprenticeship, you know, and mm-hmm. it's 10 years of doing that. You eventually, you know, you pick up a few tricks.
Right. Yeah. There's a really great podcast I listened to called Year in White, where he talks about his journey through, I believe it's Lukumi.
Yeah.
And the initiation there. Did you go through that process as well?
I did actually. My Year in White, was kind of traumatizing because I was the victim of religious abuse. Mm. Like I said, my aforementioned godfather was an unethical person. He did all the ceremonies properly for me, but his thing was he did a lot of doom saying, you know, you have to do this ceremony or you're going to die. You have to do this ceremony or your mother is going to fall ill. And there was a lot of that kind of unethical threatening of things. And what I did eventually was I pulled out my calculator and figured out how much he was charging all of his god kids for all these things and the urgency and time scale with which he was saying they had to be done. And I figured out that he was basically getting his rent money out of us every month. And that's where I decided, yeah, I'm not going to continue to do this. And I think for me, the straw that really broke the camel's back was that during my prior to my initiation, I was supposed to offer a drumming ceremony, which is a very high honor, to the Palo spirit Sarabanda, which is a spirit of iron and war. And he's a warrior. He's a real fierce, protective spirit. I was supposed to offer a drumming ceremony, and I paid my godfather the money to do it. And the day of the ceremony, he says, oh, no, there's not going to be a drumming ceremony because I had a disagreement with the drummers. And I don't want them, you know, drumming the wrong rhythms and angering the spirits. And I said, well, okay, then where's my money? And he said, oh, no, that's already been spent. And never returned my money to me. To this day, never has. You know, that coupled with during my Year in White, when you're supposed to, you know, which is a Lukumi thing, has nothing to do with Palo, but he was the same godfather for both religions for me. When I was in my Year in White, he basically just ridiculed his god kids in front of each other, said really inflammatory nasty stuff, you know, and then had the audacity to use a divination system to consult my tutelary Orisha, which is the gods of that religion, to ask my Orisha if I was a liar, to ask if I was, if I thought that I was God on this earth. I mean, like, all kinds of really nasty stuff in front of my entire god family. And then walked out of the door, went to the airport, and never came back.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was, yeah, it was really nasty. And, I mean, in retrospect, I'm really grateful for the whole experience because it's taught me the kind of spiritual leader that I don't want to be. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's taught me how to live with transparency, with accountability, with integrity, which is something that he sadly never had. And so, you know, that was traumatizing for me. I actually blogged about my year in white, and it was a very life-altering experience. You know, you see a lot of what you thought were friends go away because they just, you're like, this is too weird. I can't cope with this, you know, and they disappear. You get real clarity on what's important in life and what is not. You, of course, develop a really tight relationship with the deities that you've been initiated to because you're with them every day. You're sitting at home in front of their shrines every day. Adhering to your taboos and your restrictions. And so it's a very humbling experience. It really strips a lot of ego out of your personality. But it's a really good experience for anyone who goes through it. Anyone who's going through their year in white right now that's getting down to that like 10th month and is just dying to rip off that white clothes and put on some colored clothes and go out for a drink, just stick with it. You're almost done. you're doing fine. Stick it out. So, yeah, I went through that whole thing. And every initiate in Lukumi has to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. You mentioned your godfather sort of abusing divination, but I know divination is a big part of your practice as well.
Absolutely.
You describe yourself as a spiritual medium. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I do, I work a lot with spirits of the dead. And part of that is done without any divination tools, you know, just through the ability to contact your spirits, listen to their messages, enter into a light trance state, receive their messages, transmit them to others. I actually am a physical medium, so I can go as far as being physically possessed by my spirits. If there's any kind of like a seance, spirit contact circle, or what they call in Lukumi practice a misa, which is Spanish for a mass. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritist mass is what it is. Yeah, the spirits can come down on me, ride me, and literally just, you know, speak through me. When I'm doing divination for my clients, I typically like to use the tarot or the chamalongos. And the chamalongos are actually a Palo form of divination that uses coconut husks. Mm-hmm. It's just for yes or no questions. But sometimes you need just a real sharp yes or no to an answer. And, you know, tarot cards can be a little more gray in their answering of things. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you need black and white, and that's when you go for those chamalongos. But in both systems, not only am I using the set divinatory meanings of, say, the card or the way that the coconut shells fall, but I'm also always continually open to what my guides, my spirit guardians, the spirits that I work with are giving me as inspiration. I'll be in the middle of a reading, and one of my spirits will be like, hey, wait a minute, don't forget to consider this. And I'll bring it up to my client and they'll be like, oh my gosh, I haven't even mentioned that at all. But yeah, that's a factor. That's a play. And I, you know, I'm like, thank you, spirit. Cause you know, that changes the whole game, you know, knowing that. Cause sometimes clients are a little embarrassed or they don't think that something is pertinent to the situation. So they'll withhold information, mm-hmm. not realizing that it may be the very key to their solution, you know? Mm. So yeah, that's one of the many things that I do with my divination system. But yeah, every consultation that I do for a client always, always involves divination. And the only times I've made exceptions for that have been at client request, and it's always come back to bite me in the butt every time.
Ah, well, that's very interesting. So sort of the spirits that you work with are very clearly saying, don't do that.
Yeah. They're saying, well, why would you want to cut? I mean, we're your safety net. Why would you want to cut yourself off from that safety net?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would you want to put your divination tools down and stop talking to us? If somebody asks for that, they have something to hide, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah.
Excellent. Now, you're, I hope I can say this, you're based on the West Coast. Is that okay to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm okay. In the greater Los Angeles area.
Okay. You're based on the West Coast, and something I personally have noticed, do you think there's sort of a different flavor to the root work and the hoodoo that comes out of that sort of California West Coast type and the, you know, maybe the the Southern or the even the Caribbean style of root work?
Well, yeah, I think there's always regional differences, you mm-hmm. know, even down to calling something, you know, a mojo bag versus a, you know, a hand versus a Toby versus a Grigri, you know, there's things like that. But then there's also in the West Coast, there's a real strong Mexican influence here because the vast majority of our Hispanic population has come up from Mexico. So there's a lot of Mexican elements of folk magic in the magic that's practiced out here. You'll see a lot of people that work with La Santísima Muerte, for example, mm-hmm. Or people that will work with other folk saints that aren't necessarily recognized by the church. You also will see, this is interesting, you'll see the Lucumi Orishas worshipped by people who are not part of that religion, under the guise of either Catholic saints, or you'll see things like, you know, for example, we've all seen that Chango Macho statue. Right. You know what I mean? That has nothing to do with Lucumi. You will never see anything like that in a real Lucumi practitioner's house. But it's sort of like a folk magic way of being able to connect with the energy of that god without necessarily being an initiate. Same thing, but there's this very typical image of a woman coming out of the sea. She's, you know, she's fair skinned, she's got dark hair, and she's wearing like a light blue gown. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will say that that is Yamaya, the Lucumi Orisha, the goddess of the seas. Mm-hmm. That's Yamaya is, if she's an African goddess, she's probably going to be dark skinned. You know, she's typically seen as a dark skinned motherly figure that's very voluptuous. She looks nothing at all like this lady. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But a lot of people say, oh, I love Yamaya. And they will use that image in their work as a way of showing devotion to that particular and that goddess and her energy. So you see things like that out here in the West. You tend to see less dependency on things like the psalms with the work. We, you know, praying with psalms, people are more likely to pray just from their heart or use Catholic prayers because of the strong Latino population that's out here.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see things like that. I think for that reason, root work isn't really well known out here. You know, it's known more, you're more likely to know it or see it in like Oakland, where there's a large African American population. Here in central Los Angeles, there's people that may be a little more familiar with it, but for the most part, if you go to a Botanica or you go to, you know, a candle shop or something, you're going to see a lot of Mexican folk magic present, and then maybe a little smattering of hoodoo stuff blended in here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So, there are definite differences. And then, of course, you're more likely to see Caribbean magic here, believe it or not, than you will root work. And it's because there's a very large, thriving Palo and Lucumi community here in Southern California, as well as in the Bay Area up north, Northern California. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fascinating.
That is fascinating. It sort of reinforces something I've been seeing, which is that there is this difference even in hoodoo between sort of the two coasts. They still share so much in common. They still are sort of the same family, but it's interesting to see how they've grown in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it's the parallel to the experience that when the slaves were first taken from Africa and, you know, sort of dumped here in the States, they didn't have the same flora, they didn't have the same fauna to depend on. Who did they go to find out, you know, what ingredients to use? Well, you go to the locals, you know, mm-hmm. who knows, the natives, you know. And so their magical process evolved into root work, which is what we're most familiar with. Well, in a sense, you take that and you transplant it out west, mm-hmm. and you've got different locals, you know, and things change a little bit. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, in many ways, it's just the natural evolution of magical systems that are practiced, that they shift by the environment and the locale. I mean, if you want to get very dogmatic, what a lot of people do out here is not root work. It's not. You know, if you want to get dogmatic. I think coupling the idea of dogma with magical practice is kind of ironic.
Uh-huh.
Because magic has always come out of oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And oppressed people have never had stability. That's the very nature of oppression, is that you don't have stability. And so you're going to have to evolve. You're going to have to adapt. You're going to have to change, you know?
Right.
And
it's much more pragmatic than dogmatic.
Exactly. Absolutely. It's very pragmatic. So that's just my opinion on that.
Excellent, excellent. Well, do you have any advice for aspiring root workers out there who are listening, people who are just sort of getting their toes wet in the whole world of root work and even some of these Afro-Caribbean religions as well?
Yeah, there's – do I have advice? I've got a lot of advice. I think the best advice that I can give someone who's starting to get into root work is don't obsess about having to learn 15,000 spells to the exact word. What's more important is understand why things are done the way they are, why certain ingredients are selected, get the spirit of the spell work. And then you'll be able to craft your own rituals and understand why things are done. I have people that will email me and say things like, well, you know, I work a night shift and so I can't take my magical bath first thing in the morning and I've got to feed my kids so I can't be silent and I get, you know, and so I can't do this to the letter so it's going to fail.
Mm.
And I try to explain to them, if you understand the spirit behind why you get up first thing in the morning, why you conduct this thing in silence so that the first words you utter are your prayer, invoking God to come in and cleanse this off of you. If you understand the spirit of that, then you can adapt things without getting inventive. Because I think some people go the other, they pendulum swing the other way. And they say, well, I don't want to understand the spirit and I don't want to understand some things that are fixed as truths in this magical practice. So I'm just going to, you know, fly by the seat of my pants, change everything and adapt. And next thing you know, you've got mojo bags with, you know, amethysts in them and, you know, goddess figurines with, you know, my dream catcher that's been sewn to the side.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, none of that, that's not hoodoo. Do you know what I'm saying? It's,
right.
It's a charm bag of some kind, but it ain't hoodoo. You know, if you were talking, you've got some, you know, you got a mercury dime in there and you've got, you know, a nutmeg and you got some roots and you got, you know, a kundong or something like that. And then, okay, now we're talking hoodoo. Do you know what I'm saying? There's certain ingredients that you use, certain ways that things are done that are very typical of root work. You know, that, but you can, you know, evolve and do some slight variations in there.
As long as you understand why you're doing them. Really.
As long as you understand the reason for the technology. So I would say that is the first and best advice that I could give someone. The other thing is there is a whole lot of crap out there.
Okay.
There's a lot of crap out there. And, you know, in this wonderful information age of, you know, open source spirituality of the internet, we got to be careful because there's a lot of people that go out there and just claim that they know and they really don't know much of anything.
Hmm.
Usually what I tell people is don't just throw all your trust in somebody right off the bat. Check them out. You know what I'm saying? Take some time to get to know them, to talk with them. Find out what they're about, how they do things. See if you can see pictures, maybe of some of their spell work that they've done. Now, if they don't take pictures, because some people are really, really dead set against taking pictures of their spell work, read their articles. See what they're talking about. Compare it to some of the other stuff that you've read from, you know, a little more respectable and well established people in the root work community, and see if it matters. And if it doesn't, approach with caution. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean off the bat that they are illegitimate. I'm just saying approach with caution.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, you know, I always say that, you know, the proof is in the tasting of the pudding. If someone is saying that they are this very spiritual, great, powerful person, and then whenever they're addressing people or conducting themselves with people, they are saying really nasty, hateful stuff, or not conducting themselves with the level of professionality or humility, then you can kind of go, hey, wait a minute, something ain't right here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Because anyone who's been a professional root worker for longer than 2 years, it doesn't take long, you learn that you have to speak a certain way with people. You have to conduct yourself with a certain professionality, because people are going to be paying attention to what you're saying. They're going to be paying attention to what you're doing. And your reputation can be really tarnished just by saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say with root work. The books will only take you so far. Go find yourself somebody that's doing it,
mm-hmm.
and stand by their side and learn that way. You know, that's the, all of these things are learned best through apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's very good advice.
Yeah. Now for the Afro-Caribbean religions, African traditional religions, that's a whole nother ball of wax, because there's a lot of scam artists out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. You know, there's a lot of people that will take a bunch of fancy pots and put them around their house and decorate them up and claim that they are priests and they're not. Or they may very well be priests, but they are just charging outlandish amounts of money for the simplest of little ceremonies, or will require you to, you know, this crazy levels of obedience and humility, and don't you dare question anything I have to say. Mm-hmm. You know, that's unethical behavior, you know. So I say with the African traditional religions, if you are interested, find yourself a godparent. That's first and foremost. You have to study with a godparent. You're not going to learn the ATRs on the internet, period. Mm-hmm. You're not. You can't. You cannot receive initiation through the internet. Right. You can't. You're not going to receive necklaces through the internet. You can buy them at a Botanica. They don't mean crap unless you've gone through a ceremony, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's things like that. And then take a nice, long honeymoon to get to know your godparent. Don't go get married. Don't go jumping into something right away. Take a long time. Go to some of their, spend a lot of time at their house, see how they conduct themselves with their initiates, with their godkids. You know, go to open ceremonies like drumming ceremonies or birthday celebrations and see how they behave. See how their godkids behave. See, you'll hear tons of stories. You know, people are always gossiping at these things. Listen and hear what, listen to what you hear. See if people have negative things to say about their godparent or nothing but positive things to say. If you're hearing somebody just boasting about their powers all the times, usually the one who has the most to boast has very little to show, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you gotta just take your time and don't go rushing into anything and never allow a threat on your life to be a reason for you to undertake an initiation or a ceremony ever. Mm-hmm. That's never. A lot of people will do that. Don't allow that to make your decision. It should be something you do from the heart, something you do as an act of piety, and something you do with a very clear mind, knowing exactly what you're getting into. Now, that's the trick with the ATRs.
That's excellent advice from someone who's been there.
Very, right.
Very good.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, that's about all the questions I have for you. I've mentioned a few of the places where our listeners can contact you at the top of the interview. Is there any other place that I missed?
I have an account on Twitter and an account on Facebook. They're under Dr. E Products because that's the name of my business. Mm-hmm. So that's the best way to keep in touch. The blog is excellent. I always post the latest news, regular articles, spell ideas. Sometimes I'll just talk about a particular ingredient on my blog. Mm-hmm. The blog is a lot of information. And of course it links back to my shop, my conjuredoctor.com online store, where I have the products that I make. All my products are made with real ingredients, high quality botanicals, high quality essential oils. They're all handmade by me. I'm a very small shop of one, you know? So I pray over all my stuff. I make all my stuff and I stand behind the quality of my products. These are not no Anariva oils. You know what I'm saying? This is some really good stuff.
I take great pleasure in you saying that.
Well, you know, Anariva once upon a time, you know, way, way back when, she actually knew her stuff and mm-hmm. actually her products were of high quality. And then what ended up happening was, Indio Products bought the trademark. They bought mm-hmm. the trademark and they ended up just manufacturing a bunch of synthetic oils and slapping her name on them.
Right.
You know, and it's a shame because, you know, once upon a time, way back when, they actually were, you know, good quality products, mm-hmm. but now they're just, you know, full of, DPG, they're full of DPG, they're full of all kinds of synthetics. Yeah. You can tell if you crack open a bottle of oil and it smells powdery like soap, I can guarantee you it's not real. Mm-hmm. You know, it should smell like real plants. Mm-hmm. It should smell like real rose, not like the bottom of grandma's purse. You know, it should smell like the real thing. And if you ever have doubt, grab the plant, smell it, open the bottle and smell the bottle. They should smell similar or identical. You know, mm-hmm. It should never smell like bubble gum. It should never smell like anything like that. That's a synthetic. I guarantee you, you know? So, no, that's my take on the products that I make. And I do offer my root working services on my website. I take a real consultative approach to my root work. I'm not a pair of hands that you hire. You don't order off of the restaurant menu. When it comes to me, you say, I got a situation. Here's my problem. Please help me. And then through reading and consultation, I'll help come up with the solution. You don't just write me and say, I need you to make me a doll baby. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the way I work. It may not be what you need. It may not be the right solution for you. So I'm a real solution-oriented kind of root worker. But yeah, I offer my services on my website, and there are ways to contact me on my website. So if people want to ask me questions or get to know me or just, you know, find out a little bit more about the work that I do, there's contact links on all of those websites in order to get in touch with me.
Excellent, excellent. I know you just had PantheaCon out there. Are there any other events that you're going to be going to anytime soon?
Yes, actually. The Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Workshop Weekend is coming up in May. That's actually listed on their website if people have questions about it, luckymojo.com. I'm going to be presenting a workshop on doll baby magic. So I'm going to be showing people, it's going to be really great. I'm going to be showing people how to make doll babies in more than just the conventional way with cloth. I actually sculpt my doll babies out of clay. I like playing off of the idea that, you know, God sculpted us out of clay, so I'm going to sculpt my doll babies out of clay, you know? Mm-hmm.
Do you do the breath on them for that?
Oh, I do. I do all of that. Yeah, I breathe life into them. I baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I put the personal concerns into them. Sometimes I'll grind up herbs and work those into the clay. You know, it's a really different way to do it. I'm also going to show people how to make really simple rustic doll babies using sticks and pieces of used clothing that the person wore. Mm. Or what I call the tamale doll baby, where you basically use corn husks. Mm-hmm. You know, and you fill the corn husks with herbs and with the people's personal concerns and make them all up. And they were great, you know. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, automatically jump to a negative conclusion. But should you happen to light something on fire, corn husk burns excellently. So I'm just saying, there's different ways to handle these things. But I'm going to be teaching people how to construct doll babies, how to breathe life into them, capture a person's spirit, put it into the doll baby, baptize the doll baby in the person's name, and have it ready for working, positive or negative. I've actually used doll babies for lots of positive work, reconciliation work, for proxy bathing to uncross someone. There's lots of different ways to use them. And so, you can come and learn from me in person. You get to meet me. You can pick my brain, which I love. Questions are great. Great way to get all this information out of this thick skull of mine. So that's going to be going on. It's going to be a great little weekend, lots of cool workshops. There's even going to be a Sangoma, a man who was trained in South Africa as a Sangoma to read the bones. Mm. He's going to be doing a workshop on that. I'm dying to go to that. I can't wait to that. So it's going to be a great weekend. I got that coming up. I'm going to be at an event out here on the West Coast called Into the Green, which is actually a Wiccan/pagan camping weekend. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be facilitating probably a ritual and a workshop on that. And I think I may do a workshop on working with spirits in magic, since it is something that I really kind of have a real knack for. Mm-hmm. So I'll be there. Those are some of the two things that I've got coming up. And for now, I might be doing some online workshops or classes later in the year. People can find out about that by subscribing to my blog.
Excellent. Excellent. I highly recommend everybody do that. It's a great blog. I've learned a lot from it. I was looking at the Chemalongo entry the other day, actually, and just fascinating, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's great. It's great stuff.
So good stuff. Well, all right, Dr. E, thank you so much for being with us today on New World Witchery, and we wish you well. And
thank you. And you're welcome. And thank you for having me on. Anytime you want to ask me about any aspect of the work I do, I am available and glad to help.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Kathleen, the hostess of Borealis Meditation, Geology for Pagans. Geology, the study of the earth, so what better subject for pagans? Join me to learn about minerals, rocks, and other interesting facts and theories about the earth. I can be found at Podbean, on iTunes, and Podcast Alley, or just come on over to the blog at borealismeditation.blogspot.com.
Well, I hope you enjoyed those stories in the interview. I'd really like to express my appreciation to Dr. E for coming on New World Witchery, and I hope you all enjoyed hearing him talk about African traditional religions and conjure work as much as I did. He's definitely a fine resource for both of those. Definitely check out his blog at the links we mentioned, and I'll be putting those links in the show notes as well. Well, instead of a full spelled out segment today, I thought I'd tackle something I received as listener feedback recently. This was part of a message from listener Kaylee. There's one last thing I wanted to ask you guys about. The other night I was wondering about the use of writing in magic. Not just the act of writing, like for name papers or spells or whatnot, but actually writing narratives or stories. Like writing a story about what you'd want to happen, or even using something as large scale as a novel to affect change magically. Corey, I know you're into writing, and I thought maybe you'd have heard something like that.
Also, you've probably done more research in this area than I have. That's not true. In fact, this was the first I'd heard of it, and so this is all going to be coming off the cuff for me. Come to think of it, she continues, I'd be stoked if you guys did a show on writing and magic, like from writing spells to using someone's handwriting to the act of writing your name across other words that seems to show up in hoodoo. The last part of that we'll probably be tackling in another episode, but to address the first part of her question, where she mentions writing out a magical narrative, I thought that would be something that would be worth exploring tonight. So what about writing as a magical act? We've discussed some of the ways you can use things like name papers and magical inks before, but what about constructing an entire story? Well, basically, I see no reason why you couldn't make something like this a deeply magical act. After all, there are some really great writers out there who incorporate magical elements into their work. Neil Gaiman, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Isabel Allende, and Franz Kafka all come to mind. I think then that the trick to doing something like this is writing it in such a way that you, yourself, believe it on some level. I remember reading about Gabriel Garcia Marquez going down a river in Colombia and seeing ghosts waving at him from the shore. For him, those were real experiences which would later deeply influence his novel 100 Years of Solitude. So what it comes down to is, if you believe what you're writing, it may be a magical act. Especially if you share that writing by publishing it, for example, you stand a great chance of actually impacting a wider circle than yourself, and sending those ripples of magic out that eventually come back to you, making your fantasy a reality. And of course, as I said, I've never done this myself, and I'd never heard of it, but it's purely an idea right now, and I'd love to hear if anyone out there has ever tried this method. If so, what kind of results did you get? Email us at compassandkey@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on the show notes at newworldwitchery.com. I hope that you've enjoyed the episode. Again, I apologize Lane's not here for the show and that you had to put up with just me for most of the episode. But I do appreciate you tuning in this time, and we will eventually be back with normal shows and all that. I should go ahead and tell you that we probably will have a little bit of a break, a mini hiatus coming up. I'm expecting my second child any day now. In fact, by the time this podcast comes out, there's a good chance that we will have already had her. So there's a pretty good chance that Lane and I won't be able to get together to record for at least 2 to 3 weeks after the baby is born. And during that time, there won't be any new shows coming out unless for some reason I just kind of get a wild hair and record a special episode or a mini episode of some kind. Or if perhaps Lane and I wind up Skyping together at some point, we might record just sort of a spur-of-the-moment episode. But we will have regular episodes back eventually, probably sometime in April. And then we will have both of us on regular episodes. So, again, after that long ramble, I hope you're still with us and I hope you have enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to contact us if you have any questions or... if you just want to chat about magic and folklore, we'd love to talk about those things. So until next time, I'd like to say thanks for listening and be well.
New World Witchery is recorded using GarageBand on Mac. The song you're listening to is Homebound by the artist Jag from Cypress Grove Blues. It can be found on magnatune.com. Magnatune, your source for PodSafe music.